My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Haggerts, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we are talking about the ceasefire in Gaza, the one that was implemented or started about a week ago. And we will also talk about the Trump's 20-point plan. Walter, why are we speaking about this topic today? Because we have just talked about this topic 2 weeks ago.
I know. Yeah, that's true. That was just before this became a thing. So it's something that we have to update on, especially because it's been fascinating to observe the reaction. It is really good news that people are not shooting as much at each other as they did before the ceasefire. It's very good that there are not as many bombs and missiles being fired at Gaza. That is all great news, but the way that the world has reacted doesn't make any sense, and it's something that we need to analyze.
But you rightfully started with being jubilant about the, well, maybe not jubilant, but happy about the fact that there's a ceasefire, because I feel the same. I actually felt an unusual amount of relief, right? Because whenever a ceasefire happens with different conflicts in the world, you kind of register this, but this has been so present on the media. And I think so present in most people's minds that when the news did come out, I remember I was positively surprised. And now seeing some of the images and hearing the reports that there's hundreds of thousands of people kind of going back north within Gaza, and that the shooting has stopped and that aid is coming into the Gaza Strip. Those are good news. So people are not being shot at constantly. There's at least some food, and they can kind of return to what's left of what was theirs once.
Well, I think that reaction is what has driven a lot of the news coverage over this past 10 days, right? This idea that we as observers, people are not directly affected by it, but we see it on a daily basis, and we know that every time that we are doing something somewhere in Gaza, someone is getting killed. That created such a level of stress as an anxiety on the observing world. I mean, I'm not even thinking about how much stress and anxiety Palestinians will have faced during all of this time, right? But just the observing world, that the moment that we hear the word ceasefire, there's something like, phew, at least I don't have to worry about that anymore. I personally did not really feel relief. I don't know if satisfaction is the right word. I wouldn't know what kind of word in the English language works here, but I am obviously happy that on a daily basis now there are much fewer people dying, there are fewer buildings being destroyed. That is really good news, and that is something that we should be grateful for. But relief would imply the idea that this is the end of something, and I'm not at all convinced that this is the end. It's a ceasefire, technically, is just a pause between fighting, and the way that the world has presented this as the beginning of a peaceful future, some people even conflate this with peace, right? With that a peace has been signed. There is no peace signed. It's just an agreement not to shoot at each other. That's it. I cannot feel relief knowing that, first of all, there's a very high chance of it returning, the violence returning and the ceasefire being broken. And even if it's not broken, there is no serious plan on the table to actually create a sustainable, acceptable, lasting peace between Israel and Palestinians. There is no serious plan on the table. And so I cannot make myself be jubilant, even though I am, of course, obviously happy that as we are speaking, it's much less likely that right now people are dying in Gaza. And that is obviously good news.
I would describe it as short-term relief, because that's exactly how it felt to me. But of course, my second thought was, this is not going to last. I mean, for various reasons that we will delve into throughout this episode. But let's talk some facts first and bring some chronological order into the events. So on September 29th, so really just a few days after we had recorded that previous episode, so U.S. President Donald Trump announced that there was a new plan to address the ongoing war in Gaza. And also, because it's Trump, right, it's not just the ongoing war in Gaza, but also the whole crisis in the Middle East. And at that time, I think at least my reaction was similar to all the other peace plans Trump had announced before, right? Because he announced one right after coming into, getting into office so early this year. I think it was around February. And I mean, there have been previous ceasefires, all of which have been broken. So at that point, I really didn't take it that seriously.
No, it's because it's also not a serious plan. There's nothing to be taken seriously. If you read what has been announced, nothing of it deals with the underlying problems. It's full of empty phrases. It's full of empty words. The only thing that's not empty is that what we just said before, that they agreed to at least cease the very intense hostilities that we've observed over the past 2 years. By the way, with a short ceasefire, 2-month ceasefire in the middle in January this year as well. So that's a very clear thing. There are some specifics about, you know, where Israel is supposed to withdraw to and when they're supposed to withdraw. There were some specifics about the hostages being returned or the bodies of killed hostages being returned. Those are useful things. And for Israeli society, they were kind of an obsessive aspect of it, right? I'm not judging that. I don't mean obsessive in a necessarily negative way, but most of the protests in Israel were about getting the hostages back, and that is now being accomplished in this way. But that doesn't take away the reality that here's an 80-year conflict. Nobody has a proper answer to how to solve this conflict in itself. And any ceasefire that is now being announced will not allow us to actually reach a proper peace deal if that reality is not acknowledged, if we don't talk about the underlying causes, if we don't talk about what is actually driving the violence, what is driving the existence of Hamas, what is driving the behavior of Israel. And that's where the problem lies. And I've been absolutely amazed at the way that people believe that these 20 points as presented by Trump are somehow a path towards prosperity. It obviously isn't.
Well, one observation I would like to make here is how this peace plan came about. Because in that sense, it wasn't really negotiated between the two parties, right? It was something proposed by Trump. And then a few days after he proposed it, Hamas agreed to some points, but not all of them. And then Trump basically gave Hamas a deadline to say, hey, if not by October 5th, you have agreed to all points, you will face all hell. So that's, how easy is it to accept this plan if your alternative is, Trump really, really letting loose on all ends and maybe getting involved himself or telling Netanyahu, oh, now you can go on even worse. So that's at least one observation for me that kind of tells me that this wasn't necessarily something, right? It's nothing that Hamas believes in. It was more a necessity to agree to this.
But that even leads to a more systematic issue here. Namely, there are not really two parties to negotiate. Hamas is not a representative of the Palestinian people. Now, a lot of Palestinians will be supportive of Hamas, especially after these past 2 years, right? It's difficult to have an opinion poll in Palestine at the moment. But despite the enormous hardship that was triggered by the October 23 attacks by Hamas, right? If Hamas hadn't done what they did, it would have been almost impossible for Israel to go all out in Gaza in the way they have done. Despite kind of Hamas triggering this violence and this death and destruction coming from Israel, Hamas is likely to be very popular at the moment. However, there is no representative negotiating on behalf of the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people do not have an identity that allows that kind of negotiation. And to say here there is a peace deal or it's a ceasefire, because obviously peace is so far away. Here's a ceasefire between a group that has used terrorist tactics and an Israeli state is kind of, it's not a basis for any long-term solution. It only is a basis for let's stop killing each other right now. That's it. And not much more than that, right?
Which is why so many of these 20 points that Trump has proposed, I mean, so it feels like there are two agreements thrown together, right? Because usually at first you need a ceasefire. And so parts of a ceasefire agreement would be, here, return the hostages, return the dead bodies of the hostages, stop the firing, right, letting in aid, maybe move back to this line. But there's also a bunch of other points in here, right, that are vaguely talking about reconstructing the Gaza Strip, about talking about a transitional governance, right, by Palestinian technocrats and international supervision. And it also says in there, right, this was one of the kind of the points that Hamas held out the longest to agree on, which was the demilitarization, basically, and them laying down the weapons. That's because they had, before that, they had already agreed to some of these terms, and it took like a few days into October until they kind of agreed, and I'm making quotation marks here with my hands, to the other points before Trump then announced on October 8th that, hey, we have reached an agreement, and all my 20 points will basically be implemented from now on.
But it's a very good example, that demilitarization issue, of where the problem lies. Namely, let's say, I don't really know to what extent you can demilitarize Hamas, in the sense that, you know, how do you actually verify that? It is actually very difficult to practically implement, but let's say that there is a method to do that. Let's say that the international community is able to verify the demilitarization, the laying down of weapons by Hamas. Okay, then what? Does that mean that Gaza is going to be without any weapons? How about a police force? Because, like in any other society, there will be crime. There will be unrest. Certainly in a society that has faced not just 2 years of horrendous destruction, but 80 years of lack of institutional stability, lack of purpose, just trying to survive. So are we now going to say, okay, this means that Hamas is demilitarized. It means that there won't be any weapons in Palestine, not even for the police force. If there's a police force, who runs that police force? Where do you go with that, right? That goes back to that issue of there is no representative of the Palestinians at the moment. And this is not me just being, cynical and negative. I would very much like the world to embrace reality, that in order to in any way come to some equitable, maybe doesn't even apply in today's situation, but some kind of acceptable long-term solution, there needs to be a structural change in the way that Palestine is run, and there needs to be a structural change in the behavior of Israel. And those structural changes are nowhere to be seen in the 20-point plan. There is no understanding of that. There's no attempt to address how Israel needs to change itself, needs to change the way it has behaved. And there is no attempt to address what Palestine would have to look like what Gaza would have to look like, right? Just saying, oh, well, there's going to be technocracy run by some Palestinians, and then there's going to be political leadership by some dodgy Western leadership that we'll talk about later, is not enough. It just doesn't solve the practical issues that would have to be addressed.
Don't worry, you don't have to wait too long until we talk about these political leaders, because my funny transition was going to be, well, talking about not understanding history and not understanding cultural context, one of the kind of, well, prominent people, maybe not for the younger generation, I'm not sure to what extent Tony Blair rings a bell for people who were born after the year 2000. But Boulder, your good friend Tony Blair is going to be part of the international supervision of the technocratic government in Gaza.
I've said this before in episodes. I've got a personal grudge, like an emotional grudge against Tony Blair that goes beyond his behavior during the war on terror. I was in 1997 a student in the UK, and I read his book before the elections. The country, Britain, was clearly fed up with Tory governments at the time after Thatcher. And now looking back on it, her successor, Major, wasn't that bad, but the country was really, really fed up with the Tories, and it seemed that Tony Blair was the new left leaning leader that had an answer for the future of what society could look like. And I was so enthusiastic as a naive, how old was I, 19-year-old, when he won. And I was there, I watched the election night, and I was incredibly happy. And I thought, this is going to be great. I hope the rest of Europe is going to copy the Tony Blair model, and we will all live happily ever after. And yeah, that's, you should never have heroes, because they always disappoint. And Blair didn't just disappoint, he turned out to be disastrous for the world. I mean, he was in some ways more responsible for the destruction of the war on terror, Afghanistan, Iraq, and then the broad militarization of the Sahel region and many other regions in the world than even George W. Bush, because George W. Bush was the result of kind of a neoconservative movement in the United States, whereas Tony Blair could have easily said, I'm not going to go along with this, right? George W. Bush didn't have that intellectual or political capacity. Tony Blair made a conscious choice. I don't know, maybe based on his religious convictions, maybe based on some latent Islamophobia, to be responsible for a military operation that lasted at least 10 years, depending where you draw the line, and that killed at least about 1 million people worldwide. And this is, and most of those people in the Middle East, most of those people Arabs. And that is now the person who is supposed to somehow fairly represent the Palestinian people. Give me a break.
See, so to explain this to our younger audience, Tony Blair is basically like Obama in that sense, right? You have a lot of hope. I mean, with Obama it was even worse, right? They gave him the whole Nobel Peace Prize. And then he started basically the war with drones, weaponizing drones and using them and really kind of getting rid of all red lines here, which is kind of the basis for the world we live in nowadays, that most conflicts are fought with drones, and those lead to even more civilian casualties than other methods of war. So yeah, I have a bone to pick with Obama over there.
Well, I mean, Obama, again, so this shows my naivete in general. And maybe that's the reason why I come across so cynical these days. I had tears in my eyes in 2008, November, when Obama won the elections. I remember it was the morning, I think it was Friday morning, 6 o'clock. I'd been watching all night because, of course, the time difference between Europe and the United States. I saw him and Michelle on the platform, and I was, again, so happy, thinking this is the end of an era. This is the end of the war on terror caused by Blair and Bush. This is the end of the war on terror. Now we're going to go into something more beautiful. And once again, I was deeply disappointed. But at the very minimum, it's difficult to pinpoint exactly where Obama went wrong. I think he went wrong in many places. And I think there are lots of things that he should have been held accountable for, which he isn't. But with Tony Blair, it's completely blatantly obvious what he did. And, you know, with Obama, the conversation is a bit more nuanced. With Tony Blair, there's no nuance at all. He made a conscious choice, a series of choices that led to enormous destruction, human suffering, and death. And the fact that we still respect him somehow, we, the world, and that we now apparently think it's normal that he's going to lead some kind of Palestinian authority is, it's just completely surreal and absurd.
Going back to the topic a little bit, before we move on to international reactions to this, so now this agreement has been more or less a week old, right? We are talking about this, well, more than 10 days. We're talking about this on the 17th of October. And so the initial steps have been taken, right? So the firing, the firing of weapons has largely stopped. It always takes a few more days to go into effect, because not everyone on the front lines apparently has a stable internet connection, which yeah, and nowadays, yeah, I feel like you would. So the hostages have been returned, at least the ones who are alive. Some of the dead bodies have been returned, some others not. And we'll get into why that's the case a little bit later, because it's going to be relevant for how long this will last. So 2,000 Palestinian prisoners, right? So I think most of them have been released already. And so the first 72 hours were kind of successful for the ceasefire portion of this plan, Before we kind of talk about what this looks like today, I do want to talk about the immediate reactions to this, right? Particularly on, when was it, on October 8th, yeah, when Trump announced that Hamas and Israel had both agreed to this. Because you would have thought that this is the solution to everything, that everyone, now everyone, every child is getting a teddy bear, right? Everyone, not only the kids in Gaza, that every politician got a bottle of wine, because people were properly jubilant, particularly Western leaders, but also international leaders, celebrating this as if they have not been in politics for some years already and know that you shouldn't celebrate these types of ceasefires that early on.
Well, I think there are various things going on here. The first is what I mentioned about there being an emotional need for some kind of stability, that people got sort of tired and overly anxious about the continued violence. From a political perspective, this has been deeply, deeply problematic for Western leadership, because they initially were not just closing their eyes to the violence, but actively enabling Israel to start its campaign, right? The first, if you look at the statements between October 23 and, let's say, July 24 of Western leadership, European leadership, of course, American leadership, it was all about the good friend and democracy Israel having a right to defend itself against evil terrorists. And we would support them, we would do whatever we could to make sure that the terrorists were brought to justice and that Israel could live in peace. Whereas it was completely obvious to anyone with half a brain that the Netanyahu government would go berserk. That the Netanyahu government would go way across many, many lines. That you didn't have to wait 2 years to come to that conclusion. You could have drawn that conclusion, as we, by the way, did, immediately after the attacks of October 7th. And so as the violence continued, political leadership in Europe became more and more cornered. Like, what have you done? You are responsible for this. And it became harder and harder for them to defend previous statements. So politically, this is amazing for European leaders, because now they can say, okay, let bygones be bygones. The past is the past. Now we look forward. We don't want to, you know, put blame anywhere. Let's not look back. Let's not look at what we did in order that led to eventually at least 65,000, probably well over 100,000 people dead. No. Now it's time to talk about peace and to be productive and positive. So, of course, political leadership makes this much bigger than it deserves to be. And I think that a lot of people who generally feel that anxiety, we live in an age because of the internet where people feel anxiety about these conflicts, even if they're not the victims of that direct conflict. This goes back a little bit to the victim conversation from last week. People feel victims, even though they're not the ones who are being killed. I also feel the relief, like, oh, now I can finally think about other things anymore. The violence is gone out of my system, right? And so I think it's that combination, but it's a very unhealthy combination, in many ways a toxic combination. Being critical and cynical about what is happening is, I believe, the only way to keep any hope for future progress alive. Because otherwise, this is just a couple of months or a short period of time where we pretend that things are going to be fine without anything actually changing. And before you know it, we're back into the violence. I don't fully share the idea that this ceasefire will be completely broken. It could. I mean, we already see signs, right? I mean, there's already tensions as we speak now, and it would not be an enormous surprise if in a week's time all of a sudden we notice that it's all collapsed, because the ceasefire is built on wet sand. It's built on nothing. But there's also a serious scenario where it lasts longer than that, months or even years. But then you have to ask yourself, okay, fewer people are dying, but the actual problems and the actual other types of violence, the social violence, the oppression, will still continue, right? The issue of the Palestinian people being cornered and not being able to go anywhere, not being able to do anything with their lives, not building a proper future for themselves, is not gonna be addressed. So if I were Netanyahu right now, I would be careful at breaking the ceasefire too much, because that would, you know, create all kinds of uncomfortable political issues. But you want to create a situation where you still have the excuse to go in whenever you want to go in, and to keep the Palestinians down, to make sure that the Palestinians don't build up anything serious, because building up anything serious would be a threat to your legacy, would be a threat to you being Bibi Netanyahu. And therefore, the second scenario is not that much better. People don't die as much, but the Palestinians will still not be able to look towards a prosperous future in any way.
But I don't think that this is something that Western leaders, at least the ones who are in charge, care about at all. They care about the fact that there is not a lot of, like, very visual violence that makes some of the voters at home unhappy, right? So whether this is a Muslim Arab diaspora, whether it's more left-leaning right factions within society, because I was also surprised at how jubilant social media these groups were, because you would expect a bit more skepticism from them on, okay, this is not right, kind of looking at this and be like, hey, nothing of this solves any of the underlying conditions. Maybe social movements, right, and observers in social media and these protesters don't have international relations training, which it's nothing I'm going to judge them for, to understand that this is problematic. At least you would think that they kind of have this. So that's this thing on the one hand, right, that I think Western leaders, particularly European leaders, don't necessarily care about the medium suffering of the Palestinians, and they care more about the fact that one less problem at home. And it was so obvious, and it was so painfully obvious, and I cringed on multiple levels about this, how much they were using this to suck up to Donald Trump. Because they know exactly Donald Trump has tied his personal success to that situation in Gaza, because he is the big peacemaker, unlike like his predecessors. He's kind of seen, and rightfully so, as the person who could influence Bibi Netanyahu. And the fact that, this whole Nobel Peace Prize thing was connected to it, because I thought it was embarrassing how Western leaders basically applauded Trump, and how everyone who kind of wanted to get on his good side tried to, like, it's almost like they tried to basically outdo each other on who can suck up to Trump the most. I mean, so very quickly, Javier Milei, the president of Argentina, said, oh, Trump deserves a Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 for this. Then a few days afterwards, it was around the same time, incidentally, it was announced that Maria Corina Machado, a politician of the Venezuelan opposition, won this year's Nobel Peace Prize. So people were kind of saying, oh, he should have deserved it. But then the politicians in Bosnia had Herzegovina, I really like that because it's so random. They were the ones who said, you know what, we are going to collectively, right, the collective presidency of Bosnia and Herzegovina, we are going to collectively and unanimously nominate Donald Trump for the next year's Nobel Peace Prize. Right, it almost seemed like a competition of who can suck up to Trump the most, so that he remembers, oh, they nominated me for the Nobel Peace Prize, I'm going to be kind to them in the next time I'm in a bad mood.
Yeah, so it is generally accepted, after already having a first term of Trump, and especially now with Trump in the second term being unleashed, that the way to get the United States in any way to be supportive of your own agenda is to suck up to Donald Trump. And from a practical perspective, this goes a little bit back towards the managerial approach to governance versus the visionary approach to governance. From a managerial perspective, it therefore makes sense. Okay, just, you know, you're going to feel dirty at the end of the day because you've said something you don't mean. You're going to say, oh, Mr. President, thank you for your leadership. You're the best ever. We are so grateful for your existence. Then you go home and you feel a little bit dirty about it. You feel uncomfortable, but at least you got some practical stuff done, and you have the White House supporting you. That is basically the approach that all these leaders are taking now. Even to a certain extent, Hamas, by the way, in their reaction. You know, it is not difficult to understand how this works. Donald Trump, in that sense, is not a difficult person to understand. It's not difficult to get him on your good side. Now, at least in the short term. Now, the problem with this, besides the fact that these people have no dignity whatsoever, for heaven's sake, you know, there should be some red lines, and not everything is about practical impact. There should be some basic principles that you have for yourself. But beyond that, the long-term consequences can be actually quite bad, especially for the European Union, right? Bosnia-Herzegovina, well, whatever. They have to do what they have to do to survive. Milei, because he probably actually really does admire Trump, as far as we can tell.
And he can really use...
And he got $20 billion.
Exactly, right. He could really use another bailout.
Yeah, exactly. So so there are some where, okay, fine, it is what it is. But the European Union, even though they believe that this way they're managing the United States, they're managing the situation, what the long-term effect is that the European Union is seen as completely irrelevant to the rest of the world. That you don't need to talk to the Europeans to get something done. You just need to go through the White House. It means that Europe doesn't have any identity or vision of who it wants to be in the year 2050. And that is the price they're paying. So they're getting something short term, which politically is convenient for the people in charge right now, but Europe as a whole pays the price in the next few decades.
Just to support what you just said with a quote from the EU's High Representative on Foreign Policy, Kaya Kallas, right? We've talked about her a few times. Every time she opens her mouth, something insanely Western bubble focused comes out of it. I am really concerned about her. As a European citizen. But so on October 6th, right, so a few days before kind of the final plan was announced, but way after Trump had already announced his start, she basically mentioned that, hey, the European Union, right, we kind of want to have a role in this transitional authority for Gaza. Yeah, Tony Blair is cool, but maybe the EU as well. And then she said, quote, "We feel that Europe has a great role and we should be also on board with this," end quote. Please, that's so pathetic. It's so embarrassing. But then rather say nothing.
I know, it is absolutely painful. And it is, we've criticized this before about European leadership at the moment. These people are generally don't understand that they have a responsibility to envision a future for Europe. It's not just about today. It is not just about the issues that are happening on a daily basis. I mean, maybe for them it is, right? From a career perspective, politicians have an end date. They know that maybe in 4 years' time or 8 years' time, they will no longer be where they are. Either they retire or they go into the private sector and earn millions there. And so from their own selfish perspective, the only thing that matters is getting through the day. And how do you get through the day? By keeping your head low, pretending that you don't really matter, not having any ego, saying really, really sad things like the quotes that you just quoted, and moving on. But surely we should demand from European leadership a little bit more than that. So we should demand from European leadership that they tell us how they think Europe should behave towards the rest of the world in the next 10, 20, 30 years, what our relationship is with the rest of the world, where we draw our lines, what our principles are, where we will not cooperate with a regime like the Donald Trump regime. It is just heartbreaking for someone like myself. I know you as well, but I am a deep, deep believer in the European project, especially because it's something new and visionary in itself. Let's become literally transnational. Let's go through borders and do something new that humanity hasn't seen before. And these people, they are just managers. They have no clue on what their bigger responsibility is.
Let's talk. Let's take the last 10 minutes of this episode to talk about whether this... what is it? A ceasefire proposal / peace deal all at once is going to last. There are signs which point at the fact that, this might not happen, right? It will not last. I mean, you already mentioned before, it could last days, weeks, months, years. Certainly not forever, because we have seen this. We've seen this in the past. And so this is one of my favorite things about Wikipedia is how snappy Wikipedia editors are. Right. And so when I, as I always do, right, in preparation for this episode, I quickly went to Wikipedia to see, okay, what are the basics? What should I know? And then, right, we kind of go on for more specific sources. And if you go at least as of the 17th of October, if you go to the Wikipedia page, Gaza Peace Plan, the first sentence says, not to be confused with 2020 Trump Israel-Palestine plan, January 2025 Gaza war ceasefire, or Donald Trump's February 2025 Gaza Strip proposal. I mean, that just shows you that this is not the first type of proposal by Trump on this conflict, and certainly not the first proposal on this conflict in general, which should give you a first indication of, I mean, how much faith are we going to put into this lasting longer than 2 years?
Yeah. So as I said before, like the first scenario is essentially the scenario of that ceasefire that Wikipedia mentioned from January this year. It might be 2 weeks, it might be 2 months, might be 3 months, but at some point it's just going to go back to violence. I don't think necessarily it is the most likely scenario, but it is a very, very serious scenario. Then we can look at past peace deals and see where they ended up. They didn't end up anywhere, right? So what I am never going to do in this situation is create a scenario where this ceasefire is actually the start of a proper peace, because nobody seems to be embracing the reality that we live in, right? It's all this pretense, all those leaders still talking about a two-state solution. Okay, one state I can see, Israel. What is the second state? What would it look like? Which territory, in what way will Israel leave that state alone? Are they allowed to arm themselves? If they're not allowed to arm themselves, it's not a real state, because they need to defend internally as well as externally. So that is not a scenario. The other two scenarios that are realistic in some ways beyond the ceasefire only lasting a short period of time is the ceasefire lasting longer, but essentially being a lesser version of what we've had these past 2 years, where Israel occasionally has incursions, Israel occasionally enters into Gaza, takes military action, and the Palestinians don't have any agency over their future, right? So Tony Blair is definitely not going to give them any agency, let's face it. And the third scenario is, and that would then be the most positive, I guess, that there is a significant attempt to create some kind of authority out of the rubbles of Palestine, right? The rubble of the Gaza city and all that. Build something up, have some investments, and, you know, have a ceasefire that will never be a real peace, but where the Palestinians have some kind of agency over how they run business, how they do things. And that's also a possible scenario, but it would not be a true peace. It would not be a situation where Palestinians and Israel can live side by side in some kind of harmony, right? And this brings me back to something that we've said in the past, and when people say, oh, but why are you so negative? Why can't you be, at least give me something to hope for, you know, try to come up with something productive. Well, my productive answer is, the first step is to admit that you've got a problem for any addiction, right? The first step is to admit that the reality is that Palestinian society, but especially Israeli society in its current form, are not capable of living truly peacefully with their neighbors. It's impossible. So what you have to do is live up to a reality that either the Palestinian people in Palestine are doomed, in which case then the question, so basically they will never have a future in modern day Palestine, which means that world society has to do something else for them, create a sovereign wealth fund where they can somehow build up a future outside of Palestine. They can go to other countries and other countries welcome them, and other countries say, here, have our land, have our apartments, have our houses, go to our best universities, and the sovereign wealth fund will pay for it. Or if you believe that there is still such a thing as Palestine, then that would require an enormous radical change within Israel, where Israel has a long process of introspection, understands its own responsibility in this situation, understands the origins of Hamas, understands the origins of the past 2 years of 65,000 people at least being killed, And somehow, through this introspection, basically says we need to re-examine who we are and how we want our relationship towards the Palestinians be. And that would require going back to borders from 67 or maybe even from the 48 peace plan, 47-48 UN peace plan. At a very minimum, recognizing the deep, deep flaws that have crept into Israeli society in this sense.
And how likely is that going to be if your three main politicians are already a few days after this plan, right, is kind of announced, or after the plan being agreed upon is announced, right? So you had the finance minister, Smotrich, denouncing the plan as a historic missed opportunity, and that this will force Israel to fight in Gaza again, or Netanyahu saying that the military campaign is not over and that Israel's enemies are kind of trying to recover in order to attack us again, or that Defense Minister Katz said that, hey, we kind of have to return because we still have to destruct all the tunnels that Hamas has built, and that the IDF needs to prepare to carry out this mission. I mean, these statements are not helping. And then there's other things which we are kind of observing now today, which indicate into that direction as well. For an example, we saw, I mentioned it at the beginning of the episode, that the living hostages have been returned, but there's still a lot of dead bodies within Gaza. And Hamas kind of said that, yeah, we would love to return them. However, they are like buried in tunnels or under buildings that have been destroyed by Israeli military actions, and we don't have the tools to get them out, and Israel is blocking the tools to get them out, right? So, but at the same time, Israel is saying, Hamas is in violation of the ceasefire because they're not returning the bodies. So it very much seems like, from an Israeli perspective, that they are ready to jump back in. But from an overall Western perspective, I see the same. And that is something, that just happened yesterday, right? So on the 16th of October. And I must say, I learned about this in the least comfortable way at all. I mean, we've talked about the media in the past, but so I'm currently in Paris, and last night we turned on the TV, and the first station there was Sky News. And Sky News, right, I mean, a questionable source, maybe in general, but they just showed the video of basically six or seven people in Gaza kind of being executed by Hamas, right? And there's different versions to what exactly happened, but you could clearly feel that there's a narrative being built up to look at this is what Hamas is doing in Gaza. They're not an actor we can collaborate with or we can work with, and then Trump kind of said to this that if we might have to go in and kill Hamas if they continue this, right? So statements are really not helping us here.
No, and it's all so ignorant, right? It is so frustrating. What do you expect? This is me without any sympathy for Hamas as an organization, right? I don't understand them. I see the violence coming out them. I see the destruction, the horrors of October 23, but much more than that. I have no sympathy whatsoever for Hamas. But what do you expect after decades and decades of this? What, and then 2 years of this violence? Do you think that with just signing a piece of paper that all of a sudden Palestinian society can just get its act together and build up some institutions that can somehow fulfill our moral senses? What is going on in the mind of people? What do they believe is going to happen now with Palestine, right? It is just, to me, insanity that people are outraged about Hamas killing people, which, by the way, please don't kill people. I'm against death penalty. I'm against any kind of violence like this. But it is so pretending that the Palestinians right now have some kind of options available to them. There are no options for the Palestinians. That's the whole point of this. All the options have been taken away from them. There is no society to speak of. There is no institutions to speak of. And the only ones who have some kind of authority, based on the violence by Israel over the past 2 years, and based on the fact that they're the only ones with weapons, are Hamas. And that's it. You're absolutely right that there are a number of elements, and it's too easy to call them extremist elements because large segments of Israeli society are not far behind them, who basically want to start as quickly as possible bombing again. They're basically dreaming of greater the ethnic cleansing we've mentioned very often, greater Israel without Palestinians, without those pesky outsiders, and just greater Israel for Israel. That's it. And that's why I don't think it's a crazy scenario that, you know, we could even next week have a podcast where we say, hey, we're back to the violence. It's absolutely possible. I think in many ways, though, the more likely scenario, but they're close in terms of probability. But the other scenario is that you will see Israel essentially pretending to have a ceasefire while still basically continuing to control society, which would only increase the inability, the incompetence of Palestinians to actually get their act together, right? And this is, I think, the key point of this episode, of this whole issue at hand, that if you are an Israeli, you have to make a choice for yourself. You have to think, do I want security for myself and my family and for my country? And if so, what do I need to do for that security? And the answer, the only reasonable answer, is not kill more Hamas members. We've had this conversation so often. Every time you kill someone, there will be three other people picking up the arms, or there will be more people planning a bomb in Tel Aviv or anything like that. The answer is to radically do some introspection into how your society, your country has operated, not just these past 2 years, but these past decades. If you're really serious about peace and security and safety for your future generations in Israel, you need to recognize that something has gone horribly wrong within Israel, and that something has to change in order for the Palestinians to have any chance to be a reliable partner in the long term, right? And that's not going to be an easy path. It's going to take a very long time, but that's what needs to happen.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
This is a quote very closely related to what I just finished on, namely the idea of introspection and change over time is the only way to establish a lasting peace, certainly in this case, but always. And it's from Godfrey Reggio, an American filmmaker who I'm not very familiar with, I must admit. And he said, it is naive to pray for world peace if we're not going to change the form in which we live.